And I'm sort of acting as an informal chair, at least to just get the proceedings going a bit, to start to ask a few questions to Judy, perhaps of a more practical nature, and then we can start to bring Anthony in to ask, I guess, more involved questions around the region and your studies in ethnography and the extensive writing you've done on that area. My introduction to this work was through being invited back in the noughties, as it was.
2008,
by Judy to write a catalogue essay for the first showing of much of a narrow strip of land, which was shown at the Daniel Arnault Gallery in South London. And it was a fantastic opportunity to really have a chance to think deeply about how an artist makes sense of work in which her own identity is very deeply implicated, if I can put it like that. And so it was interesting to come and see this work installed so well here, in a very sort of sharing some of the same spatial concerns that it did at Daniel Arnault's gallery. But also, tragically, of course, the urgency with which Judy was addressing this in 2008 has, if anything, grown further. And as also new works such as White Oil have also been added to her examination, exploration of the region and her own relationship to it. So I'm just going to start by asking, a narrow strip of land, what was the premise for that? And what is that narrow strip of land?
I think something that kind of, I think most people are kind of struck by when they visit this region is that it's so tiny. It really is so tiny. Within 3 to 5 hours, you can go from the top to the kind of bottom. And what's so extraordinary as well is that, you know, the kind of diversity of landscape, which is very attractive. And as a kind of a walker and someone who really enjoys outdoors, hiking, walking, kind of the natural world, I mean, it's an extraordinary part of the kind of world in terms of species too. But obviously within that, there are all these kind of, you know, huge kind of struggles around identity. And so I think, I mean, really, it's that one. I think it also comes out of, you make a body of work and then you kind of have to give it a title, and it's always such a struggle to give titles. And to find the right title, maybe there never really is one, but in a way it just felt that at the time that's what I was kind of dealing with, was, you know, all of these kind of conflicting but kind of also kind of amazing moments that I was kind of experiencing within this kind of deeply traumatized landscape at the same time. So that's really kind of what that inspires. We often hear about that also in relationship to Gaza. Mm. So in a way, it also speaks about the space that I have actually never been to, because it's so difficult to get access to. But also, to be quite honest, I'm not sure emotionally whether I, up until now, whether I, at that time, I felt that I would be able to deal with that experience.
Would you say a little bit more about that? Why you felt you couldn't deal with that experience?
Well, I think the West Bank is, having spent quite a lot of time now in the West Bank, you know, life in the West Bank is really difficult under occupation. There's no doubt about that. But there is a kind of, you know, there is an economy, people, the earth. There is a very kind of rich kind of cultural kind of life. But I think Gaza, obviously, is kind of the devastation and the kind of bombings and the fact that it is completely cut off. I mean, and the fact that it's very difficult to access, I think, would be a very different landscape to encounter. Mm. And it's something that might happen in the future, because there's a possibility through this institution that opportunity might arise.
Your film will be shown in Ramallah, isn't it?
It's going to be screened in Gaza, but also I had been approached to do something around kind of Gaza. Mm. I'm sort of tentatively thinking about that. Mm. But I think, you know, Gaza and West Bank are two very different kinds of spaces. And I don't think they should be conflated in terms of, you know, how the occupation kind of functions.
It's interesting that a lot of work, in a sense, is moving around that territory, but absolutely about it, in a way. And if I could bring you in here, Anthony, a little bit. I mean, you know, through your editorial work and also through your own writing, I imagine this is something that you also... I imagine you must have visited Gaza in a number of different times and ways. But do you share Judy's view of it being a very difficult place to access, not just physically, but in all sorts of emotional ways?
I'm sure quite a few people have been... I've been to the West Bank a few times. And it is... It's a difficult situation. It's like in any situation in the Middle East, your initial tendency, for example, when you arrive in a city such as Beirut or Ramallah, is to start taking photographs. And that's actually quite problematic because, again, you're trying to... Especially in Beirut, but I noticed in Jerusalem as well and in Ramallah and Berzeit, when you have that tendency to take a photograph, it's as if you're trying to fix the immediacy of that moment, but you're also trying to capture something of the historical resonance. And you have to ask yourself a very simple question, why? Because these are not in any way neutral spaces. They're heavily militarized, they're heavily politicized. There are many different strands, many different layers running through them. And my interest is how artists engage with that problematic, because there is and continues to be a danger, and I know you think about this a lot, Judy, that when we go and present or represent a site of conflict, such as Ramallah, such as the West Bank, such as Gaza, that we are somehow positing aesthetic representation as a form of political or legal representation. And there's always that dynamic whereby you can make claims for visual representation, but do they actually follow through on the reality of that situation? So I often feel very conflicted in any space like that that has become so heavily publicized. I would think the West Bank is probably one of the most photographed, one of the most filmed places in the world. And one increasingly has to ask yourself a question, why? Who benefits from that? Because obviously the people in the West Bank don't benefit. Mm-hmm. If they did, we wouldn't have this problem today, because it is still, I would think, undergoing a process now of development, obviously, but Gaza seems to be undergoing a process of de-development, which is interesting too. So for me, Lucy, in relation to Judy's work, it's part of the problematic that it engages with. And I think that problematic could be generalized. We could talk about any depiction of the Middle East today. I mean, who benefits from the depiction of the Middle East today? I mean, there's obviously a media benefit. There's obviously a benefit to artists. There's benefits to individuals such as myself in an academic, critical sphere. There's benefits to an audience engaging with that. But who actually really benefits? Because quite often, the subjects of those images don't benefit. Mm. And I know that Judy's work engages with that in a very critical stance through, you know, problematizing issues around anthropology and ethnography.
Mm. And I think also the sense that you're always trying to problematize it in your work, even through the fractured spatial configurations that you ask us to engage with as viewers as we move from screen to screen, where you keep breaking it up and breaking up the frame in different ways, or else it seems that it's a kind of a mixture of that, but also then holding it incredibly still. So going back to that, I mean, I think it's interesting that the first, if I can call it, iteration of A Narrow Strip of Land included work from the Eye Hospital in Jerusalem. And it's interesting that you're talking, Anthony, about looking and who looks and what's the benefit of that gaze, or that aestheticization for people in Gaza. Because I think that idea of staring, looking in, but from an outside position, is something that you've really attempted to explore and negotiate in your work.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of interesting with the Eye Hustle piece, which isn't included in the show. It kind of focused on an eye hospital that was set up by the British in around 1881. And the Eye Hospital was originally in Jerusalem, which is now known as West Jerusalem. And then in 1948, it moved to East Jerusalem, because it's a hospital that predominantly kind of works with Palestinians. It won't turn anybody away, but its kind of focus is with Palestinians. And one of the kind of reasons being that also there's Palestinians suffer hugely from a lot of kind of eye problems and diabetes. And, you know, the kind of research has shown that, I mean, that's partially related to trauma. So I was kind of interested in trying to kind of register trauma and this kind of fracturing of kind of vision, but then trying to also think about, you know, the things that you're kind of pointing out about how, what does that mean for us as our kind of onlookers? So, I mean, this kind of partiality of vision, I think, is always something which is important to talk about in any kind of making of work, mm-hmm. particularly lens-based work, mm-hmm. which, again, thinking now about kind of white oil, a kind of attempts to do in terms of that. There's lots of information, but yet it's also quite fragmented because of the way things are collected. Mm-hmm. But I think the two works function very differently, also partly because when I made this work here, I had a very different understanding of the West Bank, and I would say I was much more of a kind of I was surveying. I was much more of an outsider, kind of, and the way I was using the camera more as kind of surveying the kind of land. Whereas in White Oil, it's a very different approach to making, because I was kind of much more. I was embedded because I was also teaching at the Art Academy. And the work really came out of connections, encounters, and quite meaningful relationships, which are, you know, still very much here today. So it's a kind of, they're two very different practices, but they are also both around excavation of histories and time and place.
Which is a good way to bring on the archive, the use of the archival images that you got from the British Protectorate, which you've been exploring in the Imperial War Museum, haven't you? And that they were the one which people have seen just here, of the aerial, the reconnaissance, if I got that right, balloon. It's again, it's that idea of topologies, isn't it? And I imagine, I don't know if this is something that comes up, Anthony, in the discourse that you know, you explore in relation to artists in the region, but... the idea of a mapping or a plotting, that somehow there's something almost overdetermined about the use of terrain or land or geography in work. And I don't know if that's just my not so informed view, but if that's something that comes through.
I think it comes through more in terms of the archive. I think a lot of artists are very conscious of not becoming cartographers, given the political history of cartography in the context of the Middle East. I think quite often it's about the archive of cartography. For example, you haven't mapped a particular region. You've shown us a map of an aerial balloon that was part of a reconnaissance, which basically produced a map of an area, which then allows power over that area because you can see that area. Mm-hmm. It allows you to... produce that area as a reality. But the archive is more interesting because I found that a lot of artists and with Judy's work here, a lot of people look to archives as somehow being representative of the past, as somehow an attempt to fix history. But I see in the Middle East and I see in Judy's work on archives, it's an interrogative gesture when you go to an archive because it's got absolutely nothing to do with the past. Archives have nothing to do with the past. Archives are about determining the future. And this more active version of an archive, I think, is a very interesting way of thinking about art practices in the Middle East. A lot of artists such as Walid Rad, Akram Zatari, Lamia Jarej, I would also include people like Emily Jassir, going in, looking at archives, not as dead spaces, not as historical spaces, but as spaces which are active. And not just active, they are determining the present and the future. Because if you can control the archive... And don't forget, the origin of the archive is archon. It means a building. It is a substantive thing which is guarded. And in that moment, it is about determining readings of the future. So, for example, when you're working with the Imperial War Museum, I didn't see you going in to look at archives as a way of thinking about the past. I saw that as a way of thinking about the future.
Yeah, I mean, I think kind of those are kind of the past and the future are kind of essentially kind of one of the same thing, aren't they? I mean, it's about kind of how has this, in this particular case, you know, how this kind of was kind of territorialized, how it was kind of constructed, who was kind of making claims to this kind of that kind of place, the boundaries and the legacy of that today in relationship to the contemporary landscape. So absolutely, it's always in relation to thinking about what's happening kind of now and what we might learn from those records. Mm-hmm. I mean, with my particular kind of research, it was also with the archives, it was... I came a little bit kind of obsessed with that. I had seen also so much material. It was also the use of archives, particularly film archives and kind of propaganda films and documentaries, and particularly with this kind of region where so much of it, particularly within so many of the kind of films that the, you know, kind of Israel and Jewish communities has kind of have produced as a way of, you know, trying to map this kind of story and actually wanting to kind of break that kind of open in terms of that, you know, a lot of them are very kind of propagandist in terms of how they kind of set up this narrative of this, you know, historical claim for, which is obviously the whole basis in which Israel makes its claim for the land. So it's how did you kind of, how do you kind of fracture or intercept that? So my kind of, one of the things that came out of the research for me, which was, it's kind of maybe a kind of longer story at another time, but it was quite a difficult excavation because I initially started my research with secondary material in the London Jewish Cultural Centre, which was a deeply problematic place to work and really compromised and actually became very difficult to make any work. And then
Explain what you mean?
I had been... The London Jewish Cultural Centre had, they had collected a huge resource in of film, but secondary material. So VHS stuff had archived around Jewish history and around the British Mandate. And so I had kind of had access to that through, I won't go into the story of that, but I had some connection with the Institute through my mother, who was a picture frame, actually, and I had hung shows there and got very thought I would start using this archive as a way of trying to understand more about this legacy. So there was a sense of looking at the past as well in order to bring up to date with, you know, what was happening today and the role of the British. But, and at that time I was also an activist, had started to become an activist for Jews for Justice of Palestine, and I think I stupidly thought that also somehow talking to people who had a very different political point of view, it might be an opportunity to talk to them or try and open up different ways of understanding this landscape. Because I think as an activist, there's no point in always speaking to people who think the same as you. You're not actually generating anything more. Anyway, it became near impossible and very problematic and a lot of censorship. And then I moved to the Imperial War Museum because I had some funding from the British Council, because they had at the time asked me to curate, again, quite problematic, a series of kind of archival screenings around archival material to do with the British Mandate to mark the 60th anniversary of Israel. And I had agreed only on the premise it would be in also the Palestinian territories, and it was to mark the Nakba. And they knew my politics. It all went terribly wrong and pear-shaped because a whole load of media representations were out of me, and I had, you know, it was in the media of like, why is this self-hating Jew kind of... It was sort of... And I had never been in that situation before. And then I, when the programme went on and I was supposed to present it, but I was asked to stand down by the British Council because they were too worried
about my
politics.
So they didn't support you?
No, not really. It was really, it was a kind of very odd few months. It was really one of the biggest learning curves in my life.
When exactly was this?
This was in 2007-8, end of 2007-8.
Do you think that's part of a broader political inflection when it comes to any discussion of Palestine today?
I think the same thing is, I don't think it's changed. That was kind of the most upsetting thing. You know, I remember, you know, the head of the director of the British Council saying, and I will share this, saying, you know, on the street corner, Judy, you know, my politics the same, but in this situation we have to, and you're just like...
So it goes
these
back
are people's
to that,
lives. Your,
that idea of argon, doesn't it? Of,
you know, well, it goes back
keeping,
to,
containing, preserving a status quo.
Absolutely, and it goes back to the Balfour Declaration, quite frankly. It's kind of, so it was, it was kind of. But going back to the archive material, this to do with this material, so much of the material that I was seeing in the Imperial War Museum, I had seen in all these documentaries like Pillars of Fire and various things, but I had never seen this observational balloon material, which was actually strewn over five or six reels. And so my role was really simply to put it together and create a soundtrack, because I just thought it said so much, and also about this kind of notion that was being presented that this was an empty landscape that could be filled with something else.
in that moment, I mean, it's interesting, again, to think about the notion of embeddedness, perhaps, because obviously you're dealing with material footage, you're editing that, you've got agency over that. But could you talk a little bit more about White Oil? Did any? I'm assuming most people here got a chance to see White Oil, or maybe you've seen it before. Could you talk a little bit about that process? Because when you talk about embeddedness, again, thinking about ethnography, thinking about what ethnography means as a discourse in the context of the Middle East and the determination of the other, how do you negotiate that as a process within your own work?
With great difficulty, and I'm not even sure I have. I'm not saying the work is successful in that sense at all. I think there are lots of questions over that. I mean, I think as an artist, you kind of, you try things, and then you do get, you know, certain things you kind of run with because they seem to feel right. What felt really, one of the things with White Oil was actually that I didn't start filming for 2 years, so I was actually just talking to people.
And this is when you were doing your PhD.
I was also started a PhD, which maybe I should kind of just mention the kind of the first question of the PhD was actually these images that Kafka had taken or commissioned around quarries in former Czechoslovakia in 2011, which were rumoured to be in Jerusalem. And I was really initially interested in the dislocation and displacement of these images and how you could read them today in relation to this traumatised landscape. Because he wrote about these as landscapes of ruin and devastation. And Howard Cagle has kind of written a certain amount about this, and actually he introduced me to the images. I went in search of them, and I didn't find them, and I kind of did some small works with them. But it was through those images, by talking to people, that I became aware of the quarries in the West Bank while I was teaching. So I originally just started talking to people, and I was also part of the Ramallah walking group. And so on the walks and the landscape, I just saw these scars in the landscape. I kept asking, and people say, oh, they're quarries. So, and then through various people, I got taken to a couple of quarries, and this is where I met Ramsey, who's one of the main narrators of the film. And I think it's a kind of odd thing when you're working with kind of film and people, isn't it? You just sort of, we just got on. I mean, Ramsey and I were very, very close, and, you know, I would visit him kind of in the evenings mainly in his porter cabin, and we just, for the first year and a half, 2 years, we just chatted. There was 1 year where I wasn't able to go back for a number of reasons, and he wrote a diary. But he really struggled with that, because he said actually he really enjoyed the conversation, because he was really isolated. He was working in the day for the water board, trying to, you know, raise enough money to feed his family, and then he had this job at night as a security guard at this quarry. And he knew a huge amount about the quarries, but also his experience. He'd been a resistance fighter, so he'd been also been arrested a number of times. So he really wanted to talk, you know. And we shared a lot as well. There was a huge amount of sharing. I mean, he, you know, within the second or third meeting, I told him about my background, and initially that was quite difficult. And we had similar politics, I suppose, around neoliberalism and, you know, kind of other kind of aspects of how, you know, certain structures around society, which Palestine is in no way also, it has the occupation, but neoliberalism is also rife, and that also is very problematic. But I think something that I kind of talk about in my thesis is it's also about how in these working in this kind of way, Deleuze talks about how, you know, your participant, your interviewer, is a kind of intercessor. I mean, they have agendas. So he led as much. You know, it wasn't, I didn't have, the questions came out of from him, in a sense. So it was quite dialogical, I would say, in terms of how we were excavating. And then I think that made him ask more questions. And then he really wanted me to make this film. You know, he told me where to go, where I should film, suggested various things.
So in that case, would you say that you played a very important role in actually formulating the film that when you was first visiting, you'd no idea necessarily you were going to make?
Absolutely, completely. He was absolutely crucial. I mean, I remember visiting him with, I was actually, the person introduced me with him, well, he didn't know him either, was a friend of mine, Nissa Frege, who's a Palestinian cinematography. And he took me to his quarry because he knew I was interested in them, and I'd been staying with him. and we visited and we met Ramdi together. But what was interesting is he was also really struck by Ramdi's stories, and Issa has, you know, he has lived, you know, every media company that goes to Palestine looks up Issa and says, take us somewhere, will you do some cinematography? He's completely embedded. He's kind of lived 60 years of the occupation. He's heard so many stories. He's made, but he was really aghast by the stories that Ramzi was saying. And in a way, what was interesting, he was a kind of barometer, because I think the funny thing as an outsider, you're also trying to kind of gauge, how are you emotionally responding to something? This is important, but is it also because I'm so unfamiliar with this terrain? This is just another story in this kind of devastating situation. But in a way, I also realised because of Issa that actually this is really important, and this is also really the invisible sides of the occupation that seems to be something which is not, hasn't really been talked about or visualised, or even textually, there's not very much written about the quarries still to date.
Could I just broaden that a little? And again, I'm just assuming that everybody's seen the film, which is obviously about mining, extraction of material wealth from the earth, its redistribution across an economy, an ecology of growth. And I was thinking, and it reminded me a little of, and I know he's an influence on your work, Steve McQueen's work, Western Deep, from 2002. And I don't know if you guys know that work, but it was a work that Steve made when he went to Johannesburg, and he embedded, to use the term, himself with miners who work 2 kilometers underneath the earth, and they extract gold and other materials. However, quite a lot of these miners, there's rampant problems with HIV, poverty, and they die very young. But also, you know, they are laborers. Their labor is worth very little. There's always more miners. Now, Steve, and I interviewed Steve at the time, and I've talked about this with him subsequently. He talks about how do you use an aesthetic, effectively an aesthetic, to relay the politics of that. Because that can never just be a moment of representation. Something else has to happen in that. And I'm going to quote from your abstract from your thesis. I hope you don't mind doing this. I should have warned you, but I thought, what the hell? It's short-ish. How can the specific properties of the moving image produce ways of thinking differently about sites of geopolitical struggle? Now, I think, and what I quite liked about that is it really sums it up. It's hugely problematic. How can the specific properties of the moving image produce ways of thinking differently about sites of geopolitical struggle? I think that's inherent in Steve's work. I think it's right across a lot of artists. I think there's a lot of artists that never, ever, ever achieve a moment where they do use the moving image to rearticulate a way of seeing. All they merely do is represent spectacle. And it's very problematic, especially when you come to the Middle East. To return to what we were talking about, it's very easy to take a photograph and put it on the wall and present it as engagement. But there's a problematic there. You haven't engaged. The aesthetic in that instant could be an anesthetic. So I want to turn it on its head and ask you, with the work, I mean, how do you achieve that? Because there's a dynamic between still imagery. There's a dynamic between moving imagery. There's a dynamic between framing. There's a dynamic inherent within the aesthetic that you're working with. How does that answer to the political properties of geopolitical conflict? And in that moment, what forms of knowledge are being produced? How does the audience, or what do you think the audience are getting from that?
Well, I think the audience to some degree has to answer that, because I'm not convinced in some ways, you know, I think there's a great deal of reflection on me whether that I have achieved that. I think, I mean, this kind of, there's two things. I'm using this static camera, and it is, you know, undoubtedly in white oil, the work is in a way very aestheticized. But it's this kind of framing in which, you know, I mean, I see the images as a number of tableaus. In a way, each or most of the images also can be read in which they're topologically describing different relationships within the landscape, and obviously from one edit to the other. And sound plays an important part in that. So, for instance, there's one scene where this young man is, you know, he's in shadow, which he's almost like a kind of a void in terms of the landscape that's being kind of dug out. So thinking about, you know, how kind of people become part of that in relationship to landscape, and those things are not disassociated, they're completely associated. But you know, with the edit, which is a lot of people probably wouldn't get, there's a fighter plane that you hear going through, because they talk about, you know, before in our grandfather's time there were not quarries here. So there's certain things, all these elements are trying to kind of configure these different kind of relationships, and also through sound and image, these kind of fractures and kind of violence to the landscape. At the same time, a lot of the landscapes, I know the camera's very moved out, and there is this distanciation. And, you know, that can seem as being problematic, that, you know, it's not this rousing, I'm here with the camera, but I'm actually really back. But there's something that I was really kind of struck with, which I think I also write in my thesis, which is this thing of I don't know if you can ever be, when we talk about embedded, I can never be. I don't live in Palestine. I have the privilege of being able to go there for periods of time, being welcomed by people and people being very open, but it's not my kind of family or life or livelihood that's kind of at stake.
You also get to leave.
And again, I get to leave, and also I have a practice which has started, you know, it's a practice which is kind of, well, this body of work based on that, and that's also kind of tricky. But this kind of distanciation, I also think it's also how close that you can't get that close. It's also about this partiality. But I suppose something that I want to do is it's like this sense of how do you touch and respect something, but also realize that you leave a place for what you cannot say.
I wonder.
So there's something
that.
Around that. I think.
I wonder on that thing of what you cannot say. One thing I found when I was writing about your work and thinking about it, and I'm shout me down if I'm wrong, was the metaphor, how metaphors inevitably come into play, unless that's just been the way that I've chosen to interpret it. So stasis and movement is a metaphor in itself that plays out, and that the audience, and I think that's another thing, do you talk about aestheticization? Very eloquently raise these problems and conflicts in how artists have come to explore or picture this issue. But it's I'm not even sure how to term. You know, it's just so broad. But I think the other thing that moving image or artist moving image can do, and I think Steve McQueen did this in the way that he showed those models, is allow the viewer to have a particular spatialized relationship to the moving image that you won't get in a cinema situation or a conventional cinema situation.
Steve used to have a different approach. How many of you here have seen a Steve McQueen sort of film? Okay, when Steve used to show his films back in the day before he became as famous as he is now, he had a stipulation. If you entered a room, you couldn't come out until the film was over. You couldn't go in until it started, and you couldn't leave until it ended. And I remember going to galleries, and Steve, and he's a big guy, would be standing there, not letting you out of the space. Like, just staring you down, standing at the door, like, where do you think you're going? And it was actually quite effective, because Steve often talks about this haptic notion, the tactility of film, the physicality of film. If you're locked in a room, with Steve standing outside watching his film, you really get that haptic sense, not just by the fact that the guy won't let you out of the room, but the sheer resonance, the sound. And I noticed downstairs in White Oil, there's carpet there which is dampened down the sound, but there's quite a physical sense of being secluded, but also surrounded. There's not many ways of not looking downstairs. You are physically confronted by a space. I don't know whether that was part of the thinking. It's a very granular film. It's very gritty, physically.
Yeah, no,
gritty.
Look, I'm kind of very kind of interested in creating that sensation. I suppose the White Oil also has a lot of script and text, and Green really, you know, it's this very visceral experience. I remember seeing the piece that you've talked about. Where was it? Near the Colosseum, wasn't it? And you go into this, it's like this shaft.
Yeah.
And that's what you kind of remember. It's almost like you're within this, and it's this sense of kind of falling, which is so kind of powerful. And in a way, he doesn't give you a huge amount of information. It's this kind of visceral experience.
And it's very immersive.
It's incredibly immersive.
But I think the difference for me about your work is, though it's immersive, you're inviting us through sound, through the way you signal through sound, to move from image to image. So rather than being completely focused into one space in that very immersive way that Steve was asking, in this work here, but also as Michelle and Daniel Arno as well, there's very much a sense that you're being drawn away from what you're looking at, that there's quite a conflicted space, and you work with sound to help to enhance that. Would you say that's right?
Well, I think that's kind of right. I mean, it was interesting, obviously, White World is shown as a double screen here, but for the first time, where it was originally a single screen. And so that had a much more cinematic sense that you went in and you watched it.
Why did you move to a double screen?
So it's a good question. With the opportunity to show it in a gallery. So first of all, maybe the reason I made, because it was my first single screen. I had been working much up until that point with installation and multi-screens. But actually, with White Oil, I felt politically it needed to be a single screen because it was, for me, it was really important because of political issues that it had mobilisation. Mm. It wasn't something which just could be shown in an art context. It could be shown in a community, an educational, political context. And in fact, you know, parts of White Oil with some of the texts in my thesis are also part of this world of Matterside, which is a group of researchers dealing with supply lines. And there, it's edited in sections, there's text. It's not artified at all. It's a bit like, this is for activists and educators to know about this subject in certain ways.
And there's other... The first time I saw it at the Barbican, it was very...
Single screen, yeah.
It was a very... The audience was a real mixture, ethnographers, as you say, activists.
So do you think, with a single screen, it moves from a documentary aesthetic and in a double screen it becomes a more cinematic aesthetic? Is that something?
No, I don't... I think... I'm still trying to kind of work out whether... I mean, I think they just work differently. I mean, there was an opportunity with the gallery to do it in double screen. A lot of people had seen it and said, I think this would work really well as a... And I think because of the durational aspect, and there had always been in me in the edit, things where certain images I thought could be very powerful together, and actually the one... In a way, the starting point for the double screen is the section around Ramsay talking about his time in prison, where... You know, the kind of the stone and the markings of the stone and this notion, relationship to time, you know, and geology and kind of deep time, which is a really important part, again, in terms of the slowness and durational aspect of the image, which is this slow time of something not progressing but yet being emptied out. But these markings on the stone were, I guess, kind of very symbolic in terms of this idea of marking time. Mm-hmm. So that really became the kind of starting point. And it's an experimentation, really. I mean, there's a few shots I've pulled out and a few shots that I hadn't used before I put in, and there's a little bit more kind of performativity. But the main thing, I think, that I have also kind of changed in the structure of Downstairs is, in a single screen, the night, it does go from day to night, but they're kind of more kind of interwoven, whereas... Here, what I've done is the kind of more surveyed, distanciated shots of the quarries, which are surveying these kind of decimated landscape with Ramsay's voiceover, are the first section, 27 minutes, and then it shifts to a single screen because it's a very different cinematography and visual language,
and that's
which
when
is
you're
with the brothers,
in conversation.
Where we're in conversation, and the way I film there is completely different. Where I put the camera and the sound recorder moves around and we're around the fire for five nights and I'm just picking up material. And I don't speak Arabic because I don't know what I'm getting. A friend of mine is mediating, and wonderful Allah here, who's sitting in the audience and spends a year and a half with me later translating all the text so we know, okay, what can we do with this material? But it has a very different language. So that was one of the reasons to actually go, okay, and this is a different way of understanding these brothers, because they're also performing for the camera a lot. You know, I mean, again, your question around the aestheticization and the kind of politics of representation, you know, actually, they actually represent themselves, because I actually put the camera up. I don't tell them to do anything. And I move away, and they're framing sometimes.
They also talk, I remember it was very playful, they talk about you. So they place you as the onlooker as well, don't they? What's she doing? She's filming us. That's what I remember.
Yeah, there is that.
And it's quite humorous. I mean,
they're very gentle. They're very humorous. And they have this wonderful scene where they also... because they were very aware. They all kept asking, so where's this going to be shown? And I was like, yeah, well, hopefully here, but it will also be showing in the West. So they're kind of really aware that the camera is like, okay, we're talking it to you. So there's this wonderful moment where they have this play around, you know, which political party or faction one of their friends is with Hamas or... And then end up with Guevara. You know, and it's enormously funny. And it's great, but it's absolutely... It's for the camera.
Mm.
So it's their stage. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is very, very different. And I really enjoyed that way of working. And I feel, for me, I'm kind of quite interested in kind of working more on that. It's in a language, when you don't speak the language, it's obviously very time-consuming. And there's kind of...
But you had... Was that Khaled Jarrar, I can hear?
Khaled Jarrar was a good friend of mine. He was also one of my students. Yeah, at the time he had just finished at the academy. He mediated, and that was fantastic.
I recognised his voice.
Did you?
Khaled Jarrar is a Palestinian artist who has been, you know, very reasonably successful over the last few years.
He made a film about the war called...
I can't remember the name of it, but he took parts of the wall down that was partitioning Israel and Palestine and turned them into footballs.
Oh, wow.
Concrete footballs that you can't kick. He also produced a stamp as part of the Venice Biennial, which was a Palestinian state stamp.
And he also produced...
Of course, you can't get. And people had their passports stamped with it, including Slavoj Žižek, thus invalidating, in certain countries, their visa or, indeed, their passport. So he's quite a provocative...
And he made my favourite piece of his, which he kind of gave me a set of, actually. It's beautiful. He made these stamps, which was part of the Berlin Biennale in around 2009-10. And the stamps with the sunbird on. And I was sitting in his studio as he was trying to work out, you know, how to put things together. And these stamps are the kind of first stamps of Palestine. In Germany, they actually produced a number of these stamps which actually were able to be used for the first time ever. It's a beautiful project, actually.
Yeah.
So, Judy, you were... Maybe explain that you were teaching there in the art school for a number of years before you made White Hollow.
So, with this work within this narrow strip of land and actually going back to the archive footage and this kind of awful experience with the British Council... I was introduced to the Al-Mawal Foundation and Jack Periskin, and they had one of the first incarnations of the Jerusalem show. And they invited me to do... They knew this quite difficult experience I'd have. I'd go to them going, help! What have I done? And they invited me to redo the programme. So we screened a lot of the archival material as part of the Jerusalem show, and I showed two of the pieces I'd made with it. And that's where I met Tina Sherwell and Khalid Rouhani, who were the artistic directors and directors of the Academy. And they invited me to come and teach. And I taught as a visiting lecturer there from 2008 till 2014. I'd go every year.
You took your Brighton students, didn't you?
And then I set up a number of exchange programmes, first with Byron Shaw, and then where I teach at Brighton for 5 years, we've been sending students. One of our students is there now. And initially we were able to raise money to bring Palestinian students over from the academy, but that ran out and then they had no money. So unfortunately, the last few years it hasn't really been an exchange. It's just been our students have had the privilege of going to Palestine, which I think has been amazing, and it produced some really interesting work.
Interesting that the discussion of, you know, talking about around the onlooker, the issues of actually how you embed or don't embed yourself, it appears that there was a quite strong level of hospitality.
Oh, hugely.
A welcome that you had, whether it's it's in the quarry or whether it's community there.
I don't know whether you have more experience of the wider Middle East, because I haven't been. I'd love to go to Lebanon and to Egypt and to other places in the region. It is a very hospitable a culture. I mean, my student arrived 3 days later. He kind of wrote me, he's French, an amazing student, you know, And he said, this is the most open and warm culture I've ever experienced. I mean, he was so moved by it. And I just, there is this kind of huge kind of openness. And I think if you're there as a kind of a Westerner, there's this kind of sense that there is a solidarity. And I think, maybe going back to questions, is that with Ramsey and all the people I was working, it was very clear. I mean, it was never only that I'm just a filmmaker making a film, but I'm not judging. I have a line. I don't sit on the fence. I might have a very strong politics. It's very clear. You know, I boycott Israel. I don't go to Israel very much anymore. I don't hardly have any Israeli friends, unfortunately, because, you know, it's just so difficult. But what I was going to say, but I think with Ramsey and something I kind of coyly write about, and maybe it's not kind of fair, but I always wonder how come he really did allow me so much into his space. But there is this real history of, you know, particularly women in the resistance, you know, were a really huge part of the First Intifada and the resistance movement in the 70s, you know. The kind of film unit, Palestinian film unit, you know, one of the kind of main women in the unit was a woman. So, you know, people often kind of claim that the kind of Arab world, you know, is so patriarchal and women are somehow, but it's actually, Palestine is not true at all, I don't feel. Not from my experience. I mean, it may be in certain cultures, and maybe Allah, you might want to oppose that or contribute to that. But I think, you know, women have a strong presence and kind of voice.
It's great to hear.
And especially, obviously, there's a huge cultural life in the West Bank, and well, specifically Ramallah, which is quite extraordinary, wouldn't you say, for such a small place?
This is problematic. We probably won't go into it too well, especially not here.
Go and say it.
It's interesting to see the different levels of development across Palestine. It's interesting to see where capital resides. My dad used to say to me, always follow the money, son. And I wish I'd learned that a lot younger stage.
bomb career. Yeah.
Follow the money. That's all I'm going to say. And look where capital is being invested in the context of Palestine today and who's investing that capital. There's a fascinating moment in Judy's film where Ramsey's talking about credit, how credit creates a relationship to place. And I took it down, actually, because it's, you know, it's really quite wonderful. He says, after explaining that everybody has everything on credit, cars, telephones, etc., etc., they have given us a life that we do not own. Now, decontextualize that, and you would think that that is something to do with Israel and Palestine. They've given us a life that we do not own. But it's not. It's to do with the Palestinian Authority, and it's to do with the Oslo Accord, and the way in which Palestine itself is being flooded with credit. So effectively, if you're looking for a model of a neoliberal development, neoliberal capitalism, or late capitalism, however you want to phrase it, look at Palestine as an example, almost a sort of sine qua non of neoliberal development, whereby, well, they've given us a life we do not own. I mean, I think that's indicative of the West as well.
Sure.
So when you ask me that question, and you talk about the development of Ramallah, I would ask another question. If Ramallah is being developed, why isn't Gaza being developed? Because Gaza is undergoing what can only be called an evisceration.
Yeah.
I mean, it is emptied out. As a town, as a city, as a space, there was no money, there was no credit, there was an absolute abject level of poverty and dispossession. And yet Ramallah is ascendant, and I was there just before Christmas. You know, it's a great place to go. It's got a great nightlife. It's got some great cultural institutions. And I'm not complaining about that. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. Then you can also go to Berzeit, where the Palestinian Museum has opened up, which is a high-tech, ultra-modern space next to Berzeit University, which is a high-tech, ultra-modern space. And you have to ask questions about where development is happening, whose interests are being served by that development, and why is it so uneven?
And in the West Bank, it's also, again, it's very specific to Ramallah. I mean, Ramallah is known as Ramallah Bubble. You go further into the West Bank, you know, and it's a very different kind of situation in terms of, you know, how villages are kind of compounded. And so, yeah, I absolutely kind of agree.
I'm interested.
I wouldn't say it's developed. I mean, I was thinking, I mean, just kind of culturally, it's also, I was thinking about how I think it's kind of interesting with the academy how, I mean, so much of the work is quite political, and it has been, you know, there's been this term used that a lot of the artists have become the ambassadors of Palestine for actually showing us, you know, kind of to some extent, obviously it's still a partiality because a lot of these, not all of the students are kind of privileged or artists, because a lot of them, you know, the academy was free, so there were a lot of students coming from, you know, refugee from the refugee camps, like Ayad, Saad, and so. But in a way, I suppose it's kind of, I feel that's kind of, it's important because the way that Palestine before that was identified was always just, you know, as in this very kind of binary opposition, and actually the way we start to kind of understand and want to know more about a place is through, often through food, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So Zaytoun has been really important in terms of kind of, you know, the food that's kind of on the shops. And it's difficult, it's complex, because I agree with you about this kind of neoliberal economy, which is deeply problematic. But it's also this other kind of visibility of a place, which actually also does have, you know, is thriving culturally and intellectually, which is also beyond the neoliberal, because I think, you know, Palestinians have always really prioritised education. And I remember very early on I started going, said, you know, oh, we learn from the Jews. It's like education, education. And that's hugely entrenched into their kind of culture. And, you know, they're incredibly, you know, amazing people to be around.
Can I be slightly more contentious?
If I can ask a question afterwards.
Yeah, sure. And actually, something that you brought up. Lucy's written a great essay, by the way. Within this narrow strip of land, and she starts with, it's a quote, and it's great. It I think to a large extent it probably goes to the heart of certain elements of what we're discussing here, but indulge me, folks, briefly. The quote is from Mahmoud Darwish. I'm sure you're familiar with Mahmoud Darwish, a very famous Palestinian poet, lived, worked at Ramallah. In fact, the Sakakini Center still has his office extant as he left it. Quite an extraordinary experience. You can still smell the cigarette smoke when you walk in. Darwish was part of a fictional film with Jean-Luc Godard. The film was Notre Musique. And he says the following. Imagine this. The premier leading Palestinian poet of his generation, a spokesperson for the Palestinian cause, says the following. And he's speaking, you know, to... I think it's an imaginary sort of Jewish interlocutor. Do you know why we Palestinians are famous? Because you are our enemy. The interest in us stems from the interest in the Jewish issue. So we have the misfortune of having Israel as an enemy because it enjoys unlimited support. And we have the good fortune of having Israel as our enemy because the Jews are at the center of attention. You've brought us defeat and renown. Now, here is something really problematic, and I think, again, and Lucy, you know, you unpack it. It's really quite, you know, good the way you do it. Here is a Palestinian suggesting that they are complicit in their own oppression, and that moment of oppression brings benefit in as much as they are the center of attention because they are the object of oppression. Now, just extrapolate that to being an artist and the notion of an artist being complicit in that too, because there is a problematic, and it's an ongoing problematic, and I think Judy deals with it in her work and in her writing, that in representing oppression, you become to a certain extent complicit in the culturalization of that oppression. So, for example, if you go to a gallery and see a picture of a Palestinian who's being cast off their land or who is dispossessed, you're seeing that in a cultural setting which, to a certain extent, neuters it or depoliticizes it. That's the great neoliberal dream, that somehow, you know, culture will step into the space of politics. Because culture is a consensual space, largely a consensual space. I doubt if there's anyone here tonight, and correct me if I'm wrong, that agrees in Zionism, for example. So to a large extent, we're a self-selecting crowd providing a consensus in and around the importance of visual culture to address these issues. Now, the problem for the artist, of course, is to blast open that consensus, blast open that continuum, and actually integrate or interject a degree of grit or a degree of dissensus into that. Because effectively, if we continue to preach to the converted, I mean, what do we change? I mean, what changes? Nothing changes. If visual culture meant anything, surely the Palestinians, the most represented people on the face of this earth, visually, aesthetically, their lives would be very different.
Which brings me to, I mean, it's great that you talk about that, because my question kind of was, what if you are an artist in Palestine who doesn't want to make work about this?
Sure.
Who doesn't want to? I mean, it's almost as if, and I'm sure that Dawush was kind of getting at too, you have no other choice but to address this, to look at how you might put that little bit of grit in there. what it's almost as if you're being always pushed in one direction.
And the art world loves it. And don't forget, the art world is a model of neoliberal consumption. If it's anything, it's on the vanguard of neoliberal consumption. It's one of the most key elements of any process of globalization and gentrification happening presently. And the whole idea of being, and I think this is common for Arab artists, it's very convenient for the Western art world to consistently want Arab artists to answer to the politics of revolution and conflict, because that enables those politics to become self-serving, but also to become tautological. You never break out of that identitarian conflictual trap. You are consistently positioned within that. The media can handle that. The Western art world can handle that. But what if you just want to paint pictures of flowers?
Well, that was the thing at the Academy, actually. I mean, in the last few years at the Academy, there were lots of students who really kind of were confronting that and saying, actually, we don't want to be pigeonholed. I don't want to make work. I have to live with this every day. I actually want to engage with my practice through something else. And this was something that was kind of really kind of supported. I mean, it's been kind of interesting for me kind of watching a few of my students. I'm sorry to offend, but I suppose when people have been students, they're almost like your children, and then you have this, you follow their trajectory and you want to be, but there's a couple of students who really were like Noa Bed, I think, who's a really interesting artist, and has shown a couple of times here in group shows, and she really didn't want to be framed in this way. But what was really interesting, she went and did an MA at CalArt. She then was on the Whitney programme. She's kind of got, you know, she started to really build a profile. And I kind of, was kind of her last kind of work, it kind of still has a, it's still subtle and poetic, but in a way, because she's been away now for a few years, the work has actually started to be more directly addressing. And I'm curious to have a conversation about that, because she was so sort of, really, while she was at the Academy in those couple of years after, I mean, she was dealing much more around gender, actually, which was also, I mean, there's massive things beyond the occupation, obviously, that one could talk about in terms of one experience as a someone living in a place, culture, anyway. So I think it's an important question.
I think of the work of Basma Al-Sharif, she's very interesting as somebody who's written recently quite eloquently in a book that I'm working on at the moment. She's done a very nice interview talking exactly on this. It's like, and also, but for her, as someone who's based in the States, she said, how can I be seen as always as this representative of something where I have exactly the privilege to be able to move in and out of in a way that those people in Gaza don't?
You know, a lot of people have that problem. It confronted me about 6 months ago. I don't know if you guys know, there's an artist called Jawad Al-Malwi. He was born in the Shurafat camp. Really interesting artist. And I went to a studio. I'd never been to a studio. His studio's in the Ramallah. And he has these paintings that I hate. And it's very difficult to talk to an artist when you know you don't like their work. I mean, you're standing there and they want, not so much praise, but they certainly want you to engage. And I'm looking at these and thinking, these are appalling. And he was very pleased with himself, and then he showed me a video. And the video was at the Shurafat camp. It's very difficult to get in there. It's quite heavily militarized, but, you know, people can go. He still, if I understand correctly, has a studio there. And he had this video of a riot, and it's quite dramatic. There was about 200 people involved with plastic bullets going off, and I think live ammunition from the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force. And you don't see the IDF, you just see the rioters. And I thought, God, this is amazing. And then I had to stop myself and ask a very simple question. Why do I think this is amazing? I mean, what gratification am I getting from this image? What vicarious gratification am I getting by the moment of distancing myself from this, but also seeing the politics or the aesthetics of it? Then Jawad talked me to the paintings, which are abstractions from film stills of the video, where he's abstracted them and beautified them and prettified them, which kind of made me ask a question.
Did he tell you why he told
you? Yeah, because he didn't want to show what everyone would expect him to do, i.e. a video of a riot in a camp. in Palestine, which is what Palestinian artists are expected to, you know, not always answer to, but there's always has to be a politics. But by painting these abstract paintings, and this is the reason I didn't like them, they're very abstract, they're quite colourful, they're pretty. And I was standing there and thinking to myself, you know what, perhaps the single most radical gesture is to go out and paint a landscape, or go out and make a work that is not about politics, because that, in many ways, subverts the consistent expectation on behalf of specifically the Western art world, but also the Western media, that somehow art of artists consistently answer to the politics of occupation, or the politics of conflict, or the rhetoric of revolution, as if they somehow have some bite-sized communication that they can relay to us.
But I think that also extends also not just to artists who are living and kind of working from that region, but there's also that question to all artists. You know? There's that the show at the Parasol Unit on at the moment by
El Garessa,
and you know, having read about it, I thought, oh, I'm probably going to really struggle with his work. And their photographs, huge, huge, very, very beautiful, almost Caspar Friedman-like beautiful photographs of the landscape in Lebanon, Egypt, and Palestine. But I was very, very moved by it, because in a way they don't try to kind of represent the kind of political space of this landscape today, where we know some, in a way those images and narratives are already here, we bring with them. And that's also the thing, the view, we bring so much anyway. So what, I suppose, kind of what kind of work do, what other space does it kind of create in which we do mediate those and think about what are we also not seeing? I mean, I think it's, I still haven't kind of worked, I need to go again, but so they're huge, huge, very, very beautiful photographs, and then there's these, what's very interesting, they're counted by these cabinets with these tiny, small photographs, which he calls day photographs, of just kind of vernacular scenes, you know, of someone standing in a field, and there's something quite kind of extraordinary about just trying to kind of find a space, a pictorial, not representing everything that we see constantly in the media and is on our head at this time. And he's very, they're always very orientalist, but he claims he's kind of dealing with that. He's not sort of doing them within a kind of vacuum of, I think it's an interesting kind of body of work.
I also heard
I'm
it for
aware,
sale.
Though. Oh, sorry,
yes, well, that's another thing.
We've got to wrap up quite soon, and I feel that there's probably some questions that people might want to ask either about Judy's work or about some of the issues that you've been discussing. I don't know if anybody.
I have a question for you.
You have a question for me?
Yes, but maybe you can ask.
Well, I think we should have some questions from. If anyone has one, of course. Yes, there's a hand.
I'm completely confused now. So you talk about the role of artists as an archivist for the future.
Sorry, Anahita?
So I'm confused of the role of artists now. If they leave. So I'm Iranian, and I've left the country, and since I've come out, I'm making art about Iran.
Yes.
But if I leave all of that and go make landscapes, I'm all confused.
I'm not. Okay, let me be clear. I'm not suggesting you go and paint landscapes, per se. I'm not saying that you shouldn't.
You're saying it's a reaction to.
I think, in the context of the relentless commodification of images from the Middle East and the relentless expectation that somehow art of artists and anybody actually making art about the Middle East should somehow engage with the politics and rhetoric of conflict, internecine conflict, revolution, and so forth, needs to be subverted by much, much more subtle means. We cannot just continue repeating the same imagery again and again and again, whether we do it through film, video, or process-based work, it doesn't really matter, because we are playing into what Said called an imaginative command over the so-called Orient, a relentless attempt to fix it as atavistic, ahistorical, belated, beyond or beneath modernism. And I think we have to deconstruct those means of reproduction, and specifically deconstruct them through practice. You look more confused now, actually. That's great. Lauren?
So you're saying the art world gives a visibility to conflict and maybe spectacularizes conflict, and that is what makes it marketable or profitable. So you're saying that maybe by making it not visible, by having this invisible nature, that if it's not desirable on a market level, then perhaps then that would be a radical move. But then how do you prevent Western or neoliberal thinking, prevent it from actually forcing political meaning into abstract, beautiful paintings?
Briefly. I started engaging with contemporary art 25, 30 years ago, as I'm sure a lot of people in this room did. I always thought it was part of a solution. I always thought of a way, it was a way of re-engaging with the problematic of representation. I now see the contemporary art world as part of the problem, and I think it's an indicative part of the problem. If you look at the way in which the contemporary art world operates as a network presently, it's not just about commodification of images. That's far too simple. It is about the culturalization of conflict so that it is, to all intents and purposes, becoming neutralized within contemporary art institutions. But there is a kudos, a political kudos and a cultural kudos attached to those institutions precisely because they seem or appear to be engaging with political debate. But I would argue, 9 times out of 10, that engagement is a neutralization of political debate in favor of cultural consensus around specific issues, which we're not really engaging with, we're just all sitting around agreeing about.
What about embedding this thing we've been talking about in relation to Judy's work and other artists?
You know, the word embedded comes from, you know, it's a militarized notion. I'm sure you guys all know this. Post-2001, actually on the eve of the invasion of Afghanistan, all of the images of Afghanistan, I'm sure you guys know this, were bought up by the American government. Every single satellite showing any image of Afghanistan was under the control of the American government, the NSA. You could not show a live image of the attack on Afghanistan. If you wanted to show an image, you had to embed yourself with the American military. That continues throughout to this day in Iraq. It happened in Kuwait. I don't know what's happening in Syria. There are no very few land forces on the ground. But the notion of embedding is a military notion. But I think for the purposes of Judy's work, she uses embedding as an ethnographic problematic. How do you problematize ethnography? How do you problematize the notion of the artist as ethnographer? But that embeddedness, again, needs to be interrogated, which I think, you know, you successfully
do. It needs
to
be continually revisited, doesn't it? Continually rethought.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Mm-hmm. Any more questions? I'm sure there must be some.
I was thinking a bit about what you said earlier about the archive and it being... I can't remember exactly what you said, but it has a future. I mean, its role is not in the past, it's in the
future-oriented. Future-oriented.
So, I mean, it immediately reminded me of the new historians and their work in the archives in Israel, in which it had been kept hidden for 40 years or 50 years or whatever, and then how that spurns a new possibility of understanding by exposing actually what had happened during, you know, the 1948. So, you know, that rang true. And I was wondering how you thought, you know, the archive could be or can be used. I know that Judy uses it, and I think she's used it in really interesting ways. Just wanted to be interested in hearing what you feel the archive can contribute to, you know, subverting the normalizing tendency of cultural objects, cultural industries.
Do you want to answer that?
Well, I think it's partly, you know, a lot of archives are in institutions, and obviously kind of the way in which they're kind of framed obviously is kind of one thing. So something like the Imperial War Museum is an archive in which things are kind of thematized or kind of framed in particular kind of ways. I think the artist thing is to kind of reframe, give a different context to that. And the kind of idea that there's ever even more than that there's one context for something is also an untruth. There's also multiple, and I think that's what artists do very well, is they kind of really experiment with this context and then how we kind of read something. We know if we place one image in relation to something else and then something completely different, that reading completely shifts how we understand that. So I think ultimately I feel like that's the kind of role of kind of archive for us to kind of antagonize how we kind of read material and kind of how we then think about that in relationship to contemporary or kind of future kind of ideas of, I mean, I think there's this thing that's been kind of going around for kind of a long time, and I know Palestinians talk about, it's actually, rather than kind of trying to just think, you know, talking about the past and excavating the past, it's actually imagining the future. So I think the question is also, how can that material be used in imagining a future? And we have to imagine a future, because the ones that are being constructed for us are so awful by the kind of systems and powers that be. Somehow we have to start finding new kind of terms, frameworks. So that would be my kind of answer.
What do we actually want from the future? What do we want from art to destabilize or to become a more lively agent in changing opinion?
I think you said it yourself. You know, art as a research practice, not just deconstructing or questioning the archive, but destabilizing the normative gesture that is the archive. And in the moment of destabilizing an archive, you don't kill it, you open it up. Mm. And in that moment, you give it life, and you give it life in the present, and you give it perhaps the ability to be more future-oriented. And the last time I sat here, probably in this chair, I don't know if you guys saw Larissa Sansour's film that was here. Beautiful film, truly extraordinary, called In the Future They Will Eat from the Finest Porcelain. And it's a great, great little film. It's about 40 minutes, where she imagines a traveler from the future returning to Palestine and embedding in the ground these little porcelain bowls with the sign of the keffiyeh, the pattern of the keffiyeh. Because archaeology, obviously, in Israel is a very contested gesture. If you go to Jerusalem now and you go to the Wailing Wall, I mean, quite literally underneath of that is a warren. I mean, they have dug beneath the wall to the extent that they've destabilized it to find the origins of the wall. And of course, the Israeli state are finding the Jewish origins, and it's very contested what precisely they are finding. And when Larissa did this gesture, and somebody, these porcelain bowls exist, they're real. She doesn't actually bury them. But in that moment of burying, or imagining that burial, the archiving, the future archaeologization of that, or archaeological digs, or the archive that can be, is totally destabilized. It's a total fiction. And she has created that oscillating moment. And I think that's a very interesting way of thinking about the archive.
I think that reminds me also of in White Oil, how I remember you saying that there was a certain law, thinking of that idea of sedimentation and excavation and relation to mining. You know, it's, again, I can't help thinking of all these circulating metaphors around bedding. And
sure.
But am I right in remembering here that it's that there was ownership made by the Israelis on, what was it, on the layer of earth which would allow them to mine, or?
No, well, there was two things. I mean, when you were talking, I was thinking about that. There is ownership, first, how far you can dig for water.
That's it, yes.
Which was the Oslo Accord, which said you could only drink. The agreement was that you could only mine 500 metres, which is not enough to find water. Hence, Palestinians can't actually, extract water. Extract seems like an odd term for water, isn't it? I don't know why. For oil and everything else, it seems right, but for water, which is somehow so much, it's everything for us, isn't it? And then the planet. But yet, so Israel can extract the kind of water and therefore siphons it off and then sells it back to Palestinians at a huge cost. But in the same way, in relationship to Larissa's film, which I know very well, and Larissa and I have had a number of conversations, I think it's kind of, there's a lot of shared dialogue around things that we're looking at, because you know, kind of obviously kind of with white oil, it's this, still this thing around something in the earth and how Israel is using this to somehow claim a kind of presence, and how archaeologists and architects, it's kind of a huge Israeli Jewish project, which is, you know, they will burrow through huge stratas and layers of and, you know, from the kind of Ottoman to Palestinian to just to find Jewish remains. And actually, there's been a lot of writing about how a lot of those artifacts are destroyed and just kind of pushed to the side as though not having meaning, in order just to find that which kind of rarefies the Jewish presence of this, you know, 2,000 years. So the kind of violence around other histories is absolutely extraordinary. And it's the same with architecture, in the way that it's kind of mentioned in some of the material, I think, around the show, but that so they kind of, the history of the stone is that actually in 1918 it was actually the British that introduced a bylaw that Jerusalem could only be made of this lime-coloured stone. And then that kind of was taken on, that legacy was then extended in 1948 and then in 1967 by Israel's within the master plan for Jerusalem, which had two things. It was, or three things. It was, one, it was around that the kind of militarization of the space and Jerusalem expanding into the West Bank. And also the sense that somehow the stone for them had this kind of emotional presence, which they wanted. You know, you have to kind of understand that for the kind of architects of the kind of Israeli state, and there's a number of players in that, in terms of the kind of vernacular everyday people who are diaspora Jews coming from lots of places, they want them to kind of really also feel this sense of actually, yes, this is meaningful me, and that we see these in the objects that we see, the buildings that we occupy. It's, and the stone is a really important part of that in creating the sense of time in history, which is something that is referred to in the film and alluded to. It's not in, you know, when the brothers talk about, oh yes, you know, there's different kinds of stone, and is the Israeli engineers are really interested in this one because this really shows this sense of time. And so lots of buildings are, this stone is being specifically built, brought in order to construct, to create this kind of sense in the vernacular landscape of this presence. So yeah, kind of, I think, kind of similar discourses.
Come anywhere to the answering your question.
It's like archiving. That's also around the problematics of archive,
and,
I suppose.
I'm kind of expanding it, and I like the way that, you know, making links with some of your earlier work at the eye hospital, and how that kind of had a conversation with, you know, with Anthony's. He's talking about, you know, the gaze and it's the power of the gaze and it's problematic. And I never realised that at the time, you know, when I saw it. And yes, and so, you know, the quarry and the white oil, you know, operates in the same way in excavating, you know, histories that need to be, that are submerged, that need to be raised, and destabilizing the mythologies, you know, that have been mistakenly or unfortunately,
or embedded, which is another problematic term of embedded.
Unfortunately, kind of embedded and raised up in their falseness.
I think you had a question.
Well, my question was just to ask Judy what her question was.
I had a question for Lucy, actually. I mean, you know, well, Lucy's done a lot of kind of writing also about kind of feminist practices and female kind of artists and moving image makers. And you've kind of wrote a book, and you've written a lot on other artists. And I was just curious, because sometimes kind of, particularly with white oil, for instance, obviously it's, I'm a woman going in and working in these very actually male spaces and these industries, and I realise a lot of my work, a friend of mine, Sonia mentioned, has always dealt with labour in some sense. I do seem to be kind of drawn to kind of certain less than other. But I was just kind of wondering, yeah, you, in relationship to a kind of feminist practice, or and also kind of wider body of work by female kind of artists, filmmakers, maybe how you see the work or other works that you, yeah, it's just curious. Because so much of your writing has been around that.
I think it's interesting because a lot of the writing that I do is around particularly Western practices. Mm. So I guess I was interested when I first saw White Oil about you, in a sense, as a Western artist, even though obviously your heritage is you know very much relating to Jewish heritage and all of and those, yeah. That you know, I found it very curious about how you were received, and it's very nice to hear you talk about how you did get such a sense of welcome and hospitality. And I also wondered about how the fact that you were female in what was a predominantly very male environment in some way gave you almost an additional sensitized access to...
Yeah, I'm sure that, I mean, it's always hard to know, isn't it, in reflection, but I'm kind of sure that there, you know, I'm wondering about other kind of women female artists here, that in some way there's this kind of problem that, you know, we're still constantly fighting this canon legacy of kind of male writers, artists, you know, sort of, you know, there's still this kind of disparity between the visibility of so many great, you know, female practitioners and something that still needs to be addressed in all cultures. But I also in terms of the kind of making and process, to what extent we have less or more access or how we navigate that. And I think that's, for me, quite kind of interesting, and it's always a kind of question. Yeah,
bring that back as a question to you. Do you feel that the... you've had less access? I mean, the thing that I often find in the writing I do and the research, I often get my presuppositions blasted that actually women have said, you know, I said, did you feel discriminated against in that situation? Oh, no.
I mean, in the actual making, and I'm not talking about, you know, the art world, because that's kind of, I'm not really that interested in that either. You know, I really am interested in the making, and everyday life is kind of where my practice happens, and that's what the relationship that I'm interested in. Yeah, no, I haven't actually found that to be a problem, and I'm kind of wondering if it's actually gave me kind of more access, because I also don't come with an agenda, and I'm also, I mean, we talk about this, I kind of stumble into things. You know, there's a lot of kind of contingency and chance.
Which
so
actually brings
I think
me back to something.
Is also, and I get encounters is something which is really important, and that thing of the encounter is that with an encounter, you know, there has to be a certain kind of open and porosity to something else happening between you, which Sarah Ahmed writes a lot about, and you must be very familiar with her work, which is really interesting.
Because you're going in asking questions.
I am going
and
asking,
and you're,
yeah,
you know, not sure. Big question, but lots of small questions, which are about them and about their particular immediate situation. And I think that's much less, well, again, Anthony... You know, you could obviously answer to this. It seems that that's much less hostile as an on. As much, you're still going to, in a sense, you're not saying you're not an onlooker, but you are. You're coming in as. I mean, this is a kind of question I was thinking about as you were both speaking. That maybe, in some ways, there can be advantages to not being that Palestinian artist in order to try and navigate and get to some kind of understanding, or in some sense portray, or in some conflicted way, the aesthetics of or address those issues of the aesthetic of Palestine through being an onlooker, through being the one from outside coming in asking questions.
Yeah, there's sure,
and
there is, I mean, in Palestine particularly, there's this kind of sense of their... in certain cultures, and there's always a hospitality to the kind of other, and there's something of that that seems to kind of... Yeah, I'm not sure.
I think you have a better term for it, and a better term is gift economy. It sounds oxymoronic, but a gift economy is quite an interesting economy, in as much as when you give a gift, you set up the reception that you will receive a gift and another point. And it engages with something quite interesting, and Derrida has written brilliantly on the notion of a gift. What is the moment of giving someone a gift? Because essentially there are strings attached. But a gift economy deconstructs any material exchange or consumption virtue by virtue of money, and it engages with interaction. And you mentioned this quite a lot, gift economy, and I think it's really interesting, the notion of a gift economy. When you go somewhere and somebody gives you something, what do you give back? And how do you avoid commodifying that relationship? Because that, I think, is a key question, which returns us to some of the broader issues in relation to the way in which the art of world is depicted within not just contemporary art, but media, literature, and more broader discursive epistemic levels of knowledge.
I think, yes, I'm getting this sign. So I think there was one last question, and then we should wrap up.
Something that I haven't heard spoken about with this work is the idea of melodrama. And I'm prompted a bit by a paper written by Maria Walsh, who wanted to reclaim the role of the melodrama, particularly from a feminist perspective. And Ramsay is a fantastic character, and his what he says is brilliant. I was a scriptwriter, and I was writing the script. There are a number of moments in what he says which are fantastic. He starts off by saying, you find it's a bit like being in the Himalayas. You're there for 10 minutes and suddenly you're at home, and that's how life works. You make...
You adapt.
Sorry?
You adapt.
You adapt. You make any life your own. And then he talks brilliantly about credit cards and how they have replaced the idea of power through the idea of credit and debt, and they're now enslaved to credit, and that's brilliant analysis of neoliberalism. And he concludes on talking about being in the same place as he was in prison before, and there's a kind of, you know, you can talk about Derrida, and the idea of the other is involved in that. So this is a brilliant script delivered by this brilliant character, which is a fantastic melodrama. And it's a melodrama because you engage with him. And I'm so therefore I have a question about this, which is, what's happening here? Is this have you deliberately or unconsciously created a melodrama? And if you have, then you can own it and say, yes, I have. Is it an accident? Is it him?
Have I stumbled into his melodrama? I maybe would say, and his. I don't know. It's a good question.
I like to think about that. You stumbled in,
but I do feel like I kind of stumbled in, and then I kind of find
obviously
the home.
As with any moment of representation, it changes the nature of what's being represented, and that's the great conundrum with ethnography. It always tries to present reality as value-free. But the reality is, an ethnographer, in the moment of recording, will always change the reality of what they're recording. And equally with Ramsay, and you're right, he's absolutely, you know, he's a gift. That guy, you know, you really did, when you're in that moment of alighting upon him. But obviously his reality, and he plays to the camera, and he creates a melodrama, he creates his own script, which is interesting, because he's taking control of a narrative there, and he's narrativizing his agency within the context of what's happening, which again is perhaps it's a whole other discussion.
But that's another gift, isn't it? That the one thing that we've been discussing sort of the whole evening is this idea of agency, of control, of movement. Mm. And actually what you did there is found a way not to be embedded, not to be on the outside, but to offer it to someone else and for him to bring his story to it.
Yeah, no, very much so.
I'll say something really quickly. If you're interested in melodrama, the BFI are putting together the complete works of Rainer Werner Fassbinder currently being screened. And I'm sure you guys know Rainer Werner Fassbinder, but he is the king of melodrama. Mm-hmm. And a few years ago, I did some research, and apparently how he got his actors to look the way they did on camera, which is quite strange, he would abuse them verbally before saying action. And then he would say, okay, we're finished, but he'd let the camera run. And they would just, their whole personalities would deconstruct over a period of this particular shooting. It was quite an abusive relationship he had with most of his actors, but it's an extraordinary moment of kind of producing that melodrama literally in that moment, but also by leaving the camera running.
I think that's the key, though. I agree with you, and I think that was what I found with the Ashley Albarn, is that if you just leave the camera running, often that's all you need to do.
Mm.
And that's actually what I did in the second, the nighttime stuff, is I just left it running, and in a way.
Talking of running, now Mandy's doing this.
Thank you very much. So.